I'm Ben Watson, and welcome to Defense One Radio. We're going to turn our attention to Pakistan. We've had at least two episodes already focused entirely on Afghanistan. So today, Defense One's Patrick Tucker takes you inside the world of Pakistani security issues. In August, Pakistan's southern neighbor, India, initiated a series of unilateral steps to police the disputed region of Kashmir, creating what many Western observers have described as a humanitarian disaster. To the north, Pakistan must now negotiate a new relationship with Afghanistan as the U.S. pulls troops out of the region. Meanwhile, Islamabad's relationship with Washington has also been in an awkward phase since September of last year, when the U.S. canceled $300 million in aid to the country, citing Pakistan's record on curbing militant extremists. So how is Pakistan bracing for all of these things, and how is it preparing for the year ahead? Joining us today to break all of this down is Dr. Asad Majid Khan, Pakistan's ambassador to the United States. And we'll get into that discussion in just a moment.
In partnership with the Department of Defense, Lockheed Martin is advancing multi-domain operations and future warfighting by connecting systems and synchronizing data across air, space, sea, land, and cyber domains with revolutionary simplicity. Lockheed Martin is committed to putting the best capabilities into our warfighters' hands with reliability, speed, and dedication. The team is developing and demonstrating multi-domain enabling systems ready for operational use today while keeping an eye on the future to anticipate what's next. Lockheed Martin understands the next generation of battle because they are already building the tools for winning it.
So, Ambassador, thank you so much for meeting with me today. And the situation in Kashmir, the Pakistan government has been trying to highlight the situation since the lockdown. I guess very recently there have been some new developments with the official announcement of the bifurcation. What is next there for the Pakistan government in terms of steps that you can take in Pakistan and related to Kashmir and also internationally trying to bring attention to what's going on there?
I think the next step would be for India to take a few steps backwards, actually, because what Prime Minister Modi did on August 5th is something that was basically in violation, if not the letter, at least the spirit of the Indian Constitution itself. Mm-hmm. It was a violation of the UN Security Council resolutions, and it was also a violation of all the bilateral agreements and understandings and declarations mm-hmm. that the two countries have issued over the last, I would say, 70 years. Mm-hmm. Now, how is that a violation? Because, as you know, Kashmir is recognized as a dispute. It is a disputed territory, and 11 UN Security Council resolutions recognize this as a dispute. Mm-hmm. Bilaterally, both India and Pakistan recognize this as a dispute. Mm-hmm. And the Article 370, which was actually a special provision in the Indian Constitution, also was a way of recognizing that this is a disputed territory and that no side would basically unilaterally alter the status on the ground mm-hmm. and that the final disposition of the state would take place in accordance with the wishes of the mm-hmm. people of Kashmir. Right. So by basically bifurcating the occupied Jammu and Kashmir into three territories, which are to be directly managed by the center, at least two of them. India has basically also opened up this possibility because they also took back Article 35A, mm-hmm. which now allows anyone to basically go into Kashmir and settle there, mm-hmm. which is again something that would change the demography of the state. Mm-hmm. And then would impact whatever final disposition the residents and the subjects of the state of Kashmir would decide if this question were to be put to them at some point in time.
So if I understand correctly, the reason for that change in the designation is to allow basically settlers from India to change the demographic nature of
that. In fact, what India has legally done is that they have actually annexed a disputed territory and made it a part of their union, which is actually a violation of their own commitments, which is a violation of international law and the Security Council resolutions. And they have done it without actually asking the people of Kashmir. And then that's why, you know, now over for over 100 days, you know, the valley is in a lockdown. They claim that they have partially lifted some of those restrictions, but they have not as yet allowed international, you know, observers to go in. They have not allowed international media to go in. They have not even allowed the mainstream leaders from India to go in. It's like, you know, someone someday deciding here in Washington, D.C. That they want to split the state of New York into three constituent units, you know, without making any reference whatsoever to the people of the state of New York, you know. So that is the kind of thing. And the fact that they actually put in additional 200,000 troops in an area which already was the most militarized zone in the world, with around 700,000 troops there already. So with about 900,000 troops for a population of 8 to 9 million Kashmiris, clearly speak of, you know, the fact that the Indian government knew that their actions are not going to go down well. And the fact that this has continued now for over 100 days further, you know, confirms that people are not happy and they are in a state of civil disobedience in Kashmir.
So I wanted to ask on that, but also, is there does the Pakistan government have any plans to also increase troop presence nearby to respond and reciprocate?
No, I think, of course, their motivation of bringing in those additional reinforcements is actually designed to essentially incarcerate a whole population. For us, our deployments, which are obviously limited only to areas that are very close to the border, are designed to basically protect Pakistan against any possible or potential adventurism from across the border. On August 5, you know, there is also a steep increase and a sharp rise in, you know, escalation on the line of control. And frankly, you know, if you were to go back, because we had this agreement with India on this ceasefire on the line of control in 2003. And almost up to 2013, the total number of casualties and the cross-border heavy artillery fire incidents, well, casualties were in single digit. And the others were, you know, less than 50 incidents, you know. But since 2014, that is when Prime Minister Modi took over, there has been a sharp spike, almost 300, over close to 400 civilians have been killed, you know, as a result of the fire across the line of control. So this escalation on the line of control, the threats that we are hearing from the Indian leadership of and what happened during Pulwama, where India actually came across and attacked our territory and dropped bombs on our side. So we fear that they might resort to adventurism, and Pakistan is ready to respond to any adventurism by India across the line of control in a befitting manner. We will not initiate anything, but if our territory or if our border is violated, we will be responding. So to basically, you know, summarize this, yes, we have to take measures to deal with the situation, but our deployment, first of all, would depend on what the situation is like on the line of control. And any expansion in that would basically be made by the field commanders based on their assessment and understanding of what the situation is like on the line of control and the border. But our deployments are in no way comparable to what India has done in terms of numbers and in terms of their motivation.
It sounds like you are maybe expecting an increased deployment purely, as you said, on your line of control for potential defensive reasons.
I would not rule that out because, as I said, that this is a determination that the military command would make based on their own reckoning and assessment of the threat.
Okay.
But whether that has actually taken place, I don't think that has taken place, but that there is a potential for that.
So potential, but not yet.
Yes.
Yes. One of the things that, when he was here, President Saddam Masood Khan of the Pakistan-administered region of Kashmir had brought up was, as you said, the civil disobedience, but also the potential for other types of violence, including asymmetrical weapons, by people in Kashmir, Pakistanis in Kashmir, that are responding to the crackdown from Indian forces. And for a lot of Westerners, the use of asymmetrical tactics and weapons from civilian populations sounds like close to terrorism. What can Pakistan do to try and prevent acts of terrorism from taking place in that region, having acknowledged that the situation there is one that the population would see as unfair?
Well, I don't know if you were able to see the statement that our Prime Minister issued saying that anyone crossing into Kashmir from Pakistan mm-hmm. would be doing a disservice to the cause of Kashmir. Pakistan has, independent of whatever is happening in Kashmir, we have over the last few years, in particular over the last 1 year, taken a slew of measures to basically go after anyone seeking to use our territory against any other country, be it India, be it Afghanistan, or be it any other country. And that is a commitment that our leadership has made, that we will not let anyone use our territory. Mm-hmm. And to that extent, the actions that we have taken, you go to our border with Afghanistan, you know, and some of these tribal areas which were at some point in time infested with these extremist groups, you know, they have been completely cleansed and cleared, you know. So I can say to you with responsibility that there is absolutely no organized presence of any terrorist group in Pakistan today. And we are going after whatever remnants are there, you know, and there is a national campaign going on. So to that extent, you know, Pakistan's commitment, and there is growing appreciation internationally also, and even in United States, of the steps that we have taken and the steps that we are committed to do even in future also.
So one of the criticisms that I've also heard is that the Pakistan government has made a lot of declarations about trying to cut down on or crack down on these terrorist groups that are either moving back and forth between the border to Afghanistan or potentially moving back and forth to Kashmir. And one criticism that I've heard is that these steps are largely cosmetic. There's arrests that are very high profile, but the problem persists. So first, what do you think of that characterization, that some of the different measures that have been taken are mostly cosmetic, but the problem persists? Do you agree with that?
No, not at all, actually. I think we have our challenges, but challenges are more on the economic side. I think on the security side and on in terms of what we have done in terms of dealing with anyone mm-hmm. seeking to use our territory, mm-hmm. I think we have taken across the board actions. Mm-hmm. We have taken measures that are certainly not cosmetic. Mm-hmm. What we have done over the last couple of years is that we have integrated all those areas mm-hmm. formally and fully. Mm-hmm. So our laws, the fiscal laws, the criminal laws, the civil laws, all laws are applicable, you know. Mm-hmm. And not just that, we have also built a fence mm-hmm. On our border with Afghanistan, just to address some of those concerns that you are alluding to, you know. Mm-hmm. In fact, of late, there has been actually more insurgents coming in from the other side. Mm. So we have fenced the almost completed 80% of the border.
A wall, as it were.
In Washington, so that's why I'm not using the term wall, but across Pakistan also, we have gone after, you know, if you look at the number of entities and number of individuals, entities proscribed, mm-hmm. individuals arrested, mm-hmm. and these arrests are not under the so-called maintenance of public order ordinance, you know, but these arrests are under specific clear charges, mm-hmm. Which would basically automatically lead to the prosecution of individuals who have been charged, you know. So it is anything but cosmetic. Okay. And then just look at Pakistan's even internal security situation, you know. I mean, last year was the lowest number of terrorist incidents in 13 years. Mm-hmm. We will have our first test match after 2009. Mm-hmm. International cricket is going to come back, you know. Yeah. We had our national cricket league also hold at least half of its matches in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. UN has already declared Islamabad as a family station once again. So all these developments are not taking place in a vacuum and are not a result of some of the cosmetic steps that I think we have gone after all these groups who were using our territory for one or the other reason. And it's not just that. I think even if you look at the very clear and unambiguous way in which our leadership has spoken against extremism, mm-hmm. the boldness with which they have stood with the minorities mm-hmm. on issues of concern to them, mm-hmm. I think also speak of the new Pakistan and the changing trends in Pakistan.
So I want to return very briefly to Afghanistan. Pakistan was facilitating talks between the U.S. and the Taliban, and I think they've since moved to China. But depending on how those talks go, what role do you expect Pakistan to play in the future of securing peace in Afghanistan? What are you anticipating? What are your hopes and what are your fears?
Well, clearly, you know, our hope is that we are able to see our brothers in Afghanistan achieve peace, finally, you know. I mean, there are at least three generations of Afghans who have not seen anything but war. Mm-hmm. And frankly, there is no other country that has suffered more after Afghanistan than Pakistan, you know. So we have a direct and a very important stake in seeing peace in Afghanistan. So our hope is mm-hmm. the process of which the U.S. Taliban is just one piece, you know.
Yeah.
It is the intra-Afghan peace which would lend long-term sustainability, and we have done all that we could to facilitate the mm-hmm. Afghan and U.S. negotiations, mm-hmm. and we fully support mm-hmm. intra-Afghan dialogue because mm-hmm. we firmly believe that there will not be sustainable peace unless all Afghans mm-hmm. are able to get to a common understanding and a common, and so it has to be a comprehensive peace. Mm-hmm. So that's our mm-hmm. hope, and our fear, of course, is that, you know, if peace is not realized, so the perpetuation of conflict mm-hmm. Will have implications for Pakistan in many ways.
One of the things that I've heard recently as part of a potential security solution with the United States taking a much less visible role in Afghanistan would be some semi-permanent presence of U.S. assets or air assets actually in Pakistan to help the Afghan government and conduct sporadic, I guess, operations as needed. Is that something that anyone in Washington has come to you with? And what have you heard about that idea? And what is your reaction to
it? There are all kinds of ideas in circulation, but I can tell you that right now we are like most of the key players in the process. Mm-hmm. Our focus, first of all, in seeing that the conversations between U.S. and Taliban are mm-hmm. revived, mm-hmm. that the intra-Afghan process of consultation mm-hmm. Also starts, mm-hmm. because that's going to be the most difficult and complicated part of it, you know. Right. What happens after that and what kind of presence, and I think that is something for the Afghans to decide.
Yes.
And I think this will be something which will be part of those conversations that the intra-Afghan process is going to have.
Well, yes, but specific to the potential presence of U.S. military assets in Pakistan to conduct occasional operations in Afghanistan, you don't seem exceptionally wild about the idea, as I can imagine one might not be. But is it something that you've heard about specifically, or is it something that you want to say outright, this isn't something that we would consider? Do you have a...
No, I don't think we have gotten to that point.
Okay.
Where we are engaged in this kind of conversations. But I can say this to you very clearly, that Pakistan would like to see U.S. exit in a responsible way, mm-hmm. that we are not in favor of a precipitate withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the U.S. presence in Afghanistan is something for the Afghan people to decide. Mm-hmm. So for us, what is really important, and that's why we believe that it has also got to be a shared responsibility where every other country also contributes, because long-term sustainability of the process would mm-hmm. eventually depend on everyone basically conveying the same message to all the stakeholders in Afghanistan.
So one of the other things that the embassy for a long time has tried to emphasize is that the situation in Kashmir, which is, as you point out and as others have pointed out, is worsening on humanitarian grounds, that the situation there has the potential to draw focus from the security situation on the Afghan border for the Pakistan government, is a thing that we've heard a couple of different times.
Situation in Kashmir?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the situation in Kashmir is the potential to draw the focus of the government of Pakistan away from the security situation on the Afghan border, because it's two fronts. Is that something that you see happening, or is it another situation that you see with the potential to happen, but not yet?
You know, really, I mean, that is a scenario or a situation that obviously we would want to avoid. Mm-hmm. But even before we get to that point, I just take you back to from where this prime minister started. Before even taking oath of office, you know, what the prime minister said was that I want to have good relations with all my neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Well, and on that, there's also been some recent reports of some interesting information warfare or cyber effects, intentions between the two countries that are sort of alarming to a lot of folks. There was a malware attack on an Indian power plant, and there's a recent report of a lot of social media activity coming from India aimed at Pakistan that is ingenuous in nature. So sort of like a variety of different social media accounts coming from India that are fake in order to manipulate the conversation within Pakistan is one example. So do you have anything to say on either of those two things, the malware attack on Indian infrastructure, the social media attacks from India, emerging from India within Pakistan, and just the information warfare and the cyber tensions between the two countries? How do you see that developing, and what steps are you taking, if any, to decrease tensions there?
Well, this is a new form of warfare, you know, which is taking place in different regions and between different countries. It's not just the social media that they have abused, but also, I don't know if you saw this report, I think there is this European report that there are, I think, 265 fake platforms that they used, basically to give out fake news, if I were to use the popular term here.
Yeah.
And to influence the public opinions across the globe. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, I mean, this is a threat that we face from a country which is much bigger in size than us, a country that has far more resources and perhaps even more and expertise in cyber realm. So we are aware of these threats and we are doing whatever is possible within our means and resources to combat those threats to the extent that we can.
Can you be specific on how a government like Pakistan tries to defend its information space from an attack like that? I know it's not something that an ambassador always has to deal with, but I feel like maybe it's an example of something that you'll have to deal with more in the future because it's a universal problem.
But I think it is, our job is and should be to basically expose mm-hmm. wherever information is being manipulated or fake news is being, injected into the discourse, So one is to go out and create a parallel stream of fake news. I don't think we are into that. But at least to the extent of exposing and to the extent of identifying who is doing what is at least what I would ideally like to do. And there are people who are better qualified than I am to basically share with you the specifics of how we are doing it, and technology has never been my strength. But I can say this to you that yes, I think like most of the countries here, even here in the United States, we see this as a growing theater where we need to do more to protect our interests. And there are more and more threats, the soft threats that are coming from this channel also. And there are people in Pakistan that are looking at it and drawing up appropriate strategies.
Okay. I assume you don't have anything to comment on the presence of malware on aspects of Indian nuclear infrastructure.
I have nothing to. I don't know much about that, and I don't know if I'm qualified to comment on that.
Thank you for spending some time with me today to talk about these things. I really appreciate the availability, and I learned a lot.
But in closing, really, I think what you spoke about the extremism and some of these groups using our territory and space. But and since you cover South Asia, I do want to make this point to you that, I mean, in Pakistan, such groups have always been in the on the fringe. They have never been part of the political mainstream because all the major political parties are more, center, slightly to the right of the center, slightly to the left of the center. And our extreme right or extreme groups have never been part of the political mainstream. But in India, unfortunately, right now, their fringe has become the mainstream, And BJP actually represents that. And these actions, one after the other, the first what they did in Kashmir, and which was partly motivated by their desire to get that one single state in the Indian Union, which was a Muslim majority state, and by breaking it up, they have basically taken away that title and that status that Kashmir had before, And the kind of terminology that they are using is basically bringing their extremist fringe into the mainstream. And that is going to be a long-term security threat for South Asia. Because whatever happens in India, then our own extremist groups draw oxygen from there.
That's it for us this week. Special thanks to Patrick Tucker and, of course, the Pakistan Embassy. Have a great holiday, everyone, and until next time.
Hello and welcome. I'm Juliet Van Wagenen, editor of branded content for Studio 2G here at Government Executive Media Group, and I'm sitting down today with Mike Smith, Vice President of Corporate Strategy at Lockheed Martin. Mike is going to share his insights into the present and future of multi-domain operations. Mike, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Juliet.
Let's get right into it. So to begin, how does Lockheed Martin look at multi-domain operations, and how are you contributing to the realization of MDO as an actionable and operational operational concept?
That's a fantastic question. You know, when we think about multi-domain operations, it's really about connecting dots. And at Lockheed, we happen to be the designers and integrators of many of these dots. And, you know, these dots are represented by systems embedded within platforms, platforms that host and protect these systems. It's also about securing the communications between these systems. So we also have to note the fact that these nodes aren't necessarily 100% secure and safe. So the beauty of a network system is that it's resilient and it's almost self-regenerating. With broad customer intimacy, with the deep mission understanding that we've developed over these decades of service to our customers, and the world's largest defense technology portfolio, Lockheed Martin is uniquely positioned to serve as this mission of missions integrator, which is a role that's it's really requisite to unlock the full promise of multi-domain operations. And I do want to emphasize that MDO is not a single platform. It's not a program. It really is a concept of operations. It's a way of warfighting. And it's a way of warfighting that isn't new. I mean, it's been around since the advent of war. An example from history, going back to the Civil War, General Ulysses S. Grant coordinated quite closely with Admiral David Porter during the Vicksburg Campaign. Grant's army provided observer and spotter information to Porter's afloat assets to provide gunfire during that campaign. That's actually multi-domain operations. It can be that simple, but the concept isn't new. What has changed are the technologies that we've used to enhance the lethality and precision of those operations. And so when I was talking about the complexity of networks, that there's also a exponential impact on the volume of data that these networked sensors are providing to the warfighter. Extrapolating technological advance, you can expect that the proliferation of data streams to warfighters will continue to go up. And so how does the warfighter respond? Well, that drives the need for artificial intelligence algorithms that will help simplify the decision-making loop for the warfighter, because at the end of the day, it's all about making smart decisions as quickly as possible. So the biggest challenge that we're going to be facing is a challenge that is a result of technological advance. So, you know, in time, I'd say the focus, you know, within industry will be integrating AI and autonomy into these growing network of connected sensors.
Speaking more to the future, when we look 10 to 20 years down the road, what are the most difficult technical challenges to solve?
Going back to the discussion around networks, as we add nodes to these networks, we're actually adding sensors, and those sensors are providing more and more data. And so the challenge is, how do we fuse that data in ways that don't confuse the warfighter? I think synthesizing this ever-expanding set of data streams, I think that's where the challenge is, because we need to take these streams and form a tactical plot, and that plot needs to give the warfighter the opportunity to take prompt and decisive action within the adversary's decision loop.
Great. And so can you give us some realistic examples of Lockheed Martin proving their MDO expertise?
Absolutely. A recent example of this was just 2 months ago in June during the Orange Flag exercise. And here, Lockheed Martin and the Army and the Air Force demonstrated for the first time F-35's ability to track live data, send that data to an integrated air and missile defense platform, which was based in El Paso, Texas, while the F-35 was actually conducting operations in Palmdale, California. And what this demonstrated was the fact that you could have a elevated sensor providing live fire control quality data to an asset hundreds of miles away on the ground. Another thing that Lockheed Martin has invested in is our ability to connect high-end laboratories, research centers, our engineering facilities in a collaborative environment so that we could bring the customer down from all branches of services, because multi-domain is joint in and of its nature. We can bring them down to a facility called the Lighthouse, which is in Suffolk, Virginia. And it's a 50,000 square foot facility. It's a high-end laboratory. It provides virtual and physical portals that just allow the customer to connect into Lockheed Martin's vast network of capabilities. And it's here where we can conduct multi-domain integration, experimentation, warfighting, tabletops, you name it, where, you know, alongside our engineers, our customers can innovate and ideate about how we can take and combine technologies and platforms in ways that the customer never imagined could be done.
It's fascinating. Okay, well, thank you so much. I think that's all we have time for today. Thank you for joining me today. And thank you to everyone listening to our podcast. Stay tuned for more episodes coming soon.